March 31st, the last day of March.
Permanent fund dividend application day.
That's right, get your PFD application in. Or actually, don't get it in, then that'll mean more for the rest of us.
Well, if you get a constitutional amendment, it might be a little...
Joined this morning by Chair Green, Senator Stevens, Senator Bundy, Senator Olson, Senator Hoffman, and Senator Dyson. Morning, everybody. Purpose of today's meeting is to take up two pieces of legislation. Senate Bill 357, we're going to start with that, having to do with clean up some of our insurance statutes. And then we were going to hear Senate Bill 366, sales tax. And Senator Stevens, kind of give us an update on where you are on that, please.
We were just handed the fiscal note 10 minutes before the meeting, Mr. Chairman. I haven't had a chance to look at it and make some responses. So I request it tomorrow.
So tomorrow? Okay.
Do you have another request?
Pardon me?
I do have another request.
Yeah, try me. Okay. What is it?
We had the hearing on 374, but we didn't have a fiscal note. Can you send a request to Department of Revenue to get a fiscal note on SB 374?
What was 374 about?
That's my inflation calculation.
Bed sheet, okay.
Bed sheet spreadsheet. See if Revenue can do a little bit better job of making the bed than me.
You bet. We'll do that. Thank you, Senator Stevens. And okay, so 366 tomorrow, Thursday. And let's see. Sheila, do you have tomorrow's schedule? We'll bring that back and see how we're going to fit that in. Okay. Let's see. And then after we finish 357, we'll go back to SJR 3 and spend some time on that and walk through some amendments. Senator Green, anything from the operating side? Nothing? Okay. Anything from other members of the committee before we begin? All right, let's begin our agenda today and bring before us Senate Bill 357. Senate Bill 357 is sponsored by Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. It's known as the Insurance Omnibus Bill, and it contains numerous changes to ensure that state statutes are consistent with federal law, Model Act standards, and guidelines. And let's see, who's going to, Linda, I think, is here. Division of Insurance is here. I don't have anybody on teleconference, and no one signed up to testify. We do have one amendment that Representative Roquebrune has offered, and we'll get to that, and Janet is here this morning to talk about that. So before we do that, let's start with the administration and welcome Ms. Hall to the table. Good morning. Welcome to Finance. If you will, please present the bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Senate Labor and Commerce sponsored the bill, and I believe Senator Bundy was going to do an introduction.
Okay. Senator Bundy?
Many are called, few are chosen. Mr. Chairman, this bill indeed was a Labor and Commerce bill at the request of the administration. For convenience, we refer to it as the Insurance Omnibus Bill, and it really is a technical cleanup bill, hoping that doesn't condemn the bill by calling it merely technical. Contains numerous changes to Title 21, ensuring that state is consistent with federal law, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, their Model Act standards and guidelines. It updates procedures and transactions within the Division of Insurance. The key elements of this bill are six. One, it provides for electronic communication, which in this day and age I think is a no-brainer. Two, it provides for changes in the reinsurance capabilities in Alaska. Three, it contains recommendations for licensing revision that have been suggested by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. Makes changes in liability for civil damages when filing a report concerning fraudulent acts. Five, it contains provisions that clarify that a guarantee fund deposit is required for title insurance companies. And number six. It makes changes to taxes and late payments to make penalties more consistent with those of the Department of Revenue statutes. These changes to Title 21 promote consistency between Alaska and other states, should promote a more efficient operation. And with that, I will now have exceeded my knowledge in the insurance business.
Thank you, Senator Bundy. Well done. Questions of Labor and Commerce, Senator Bundy, or Ms. Hall? Okay. Janet, if you'd join us, I would move Amendment Number 1, which you have a copy of. It's my intent, just so folks know. This is a cleanup bill, and so we'll let it sit for a day or two. And if there's any concerns that folks might have, please let me know. If not, then we'll just bring it back to pass this out this week. So, Senator Dyson?
Yeah, I have a question I'd like to ask.
Sure.
If I may.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh. In your indulgence, the first question relates to the bill, and the second one is a little more generic. My understanding of the health care providers is that there's a significant amount of cost shifting that goes on within the industry, and that certainly appears like, and I think it's true, that costs get shifted to areas where there's a third-party payer. And the areas where particularly the hospitals have very little cost recovery, i.e. the emergency rooms and so on and so forth, the cost of operating gets shifted to other services they provide. And you could sure argue from the evidence that it's consciously shifted to where there's third-party payers. Do we have a responsibility to ensure that insurance companies are only paying for the costs that the patient actually incurred and are not paying for the hospital's unrecoverable debts from other services?
The Chair, Senator Dyson.
And to get a little closer to that microphone, sure. If you would, please. Thank you.
Through the Chair, Senator Dyson. That's a philosophical policy question that I'm not really prepared to answer. I would be happy to discuss that with my staff, who do the primary oversight of the health insurers and our oversight. I've never been asked that in those terms before, and prior to answering that, I would really like to do some additional research, if that would be acceptable.
Yeah, it is, and I think that that's a wise choice. And with your indulgence, Mr. Chairman, I'll ask one more question. We'll have, and I'm very confident what I'm going to say is true, we are in the very unfortunate circumstances where third-party payers, the large insurance carriers and the self-insured, negotiate with the providers for very significant discounts on services, always at least a 30% discount, and we leave the self-payers, the last three of them in Alaska that actually pay their own bills and take responsibility for their own health care, we leave them in the unenviable position of having to pay 100% of the billing rate, where everybody else gets a discount, and they get to pay the privilege of paying for the provider's services that on which they don't get cost recovery. And I would enjoy a discussion with you and your folks about the possibility of making sure that self-payers, may their tribe increase, actually get the same discount that
the third-party payers get. So I'm at your convenience when you'd like to have that discussion.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I would be happy to bring one of my staff over and have that discussion with you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your indulgence.
Mr. Chairman, pardon my interruption. No, I do have some comments on the bill.
Oh, please, you bet.
I didn't mean to let Senator Bundy do the whole discussion.
One question before we begin. Are we on version D?
Let's see. We're on version H, I believe. Are we not?
No.
Senator Bundy?
Mr.
Yes.
Chairman?
Are we on version?
The amendment is prepared for version D. That's why I was requesting. That's why I was asking. So we're on version H. Okay.
Version hotel. All right.
So it may not make a difference on the amendment, but.
Okay. But thanks for pointing that out. And let's, we'll come back to that amendment here just shortly. Okay. Any other questions of Senator Bundy before we go to Linda? Okay. Linda, fill in the blanks.
I would like to, I'm not going through all 28 pages of the bill, just I would like to start with that.
You can identify yourself for the record.
I'm sorry. Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance. And I have a number of comments to make about the bill. I would be happy to entertain questions. The purpose of the bill is to make some changes that are required in the accreditation process that the Division of Insurance goes through with the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. It also makes some changes to correspond with some of the national producer licensing requirements. There are six major areas of change. One, as Senator Bundy has pointed out, is electronic communication, the ability to allow various communications for the services we provide to be performed electronically. We have financial forms that are filed electronically, and we're trying to gradually increase the ability to communicate with our public in that manner. Second area is late tax payments. Currently, we have some fairly high penalties that are mandatory for late payments. There are four sections in the bill that revise the penalties to make them more consistent with the Department of Revenue. We also add a new section that is an up to $10,000 penalties for willful late payments of taxes. The reinsurance piece of the bill is probably the most complex. It is the only area of the bill that I've received any comments from industry on. There are two sections. One is reflected in version H. It is a CS. Originally, the bill proposed that the Division of Insurance must approve reinsurance treaties that insurance companies entered into with reinsurance insurers. We have changed that merely to require that they file their signed agreements with us. In some financial examinations, we've had difficulty getting signed reinsurance agreements, and we want to be sure we have those available for our review when we're reviewing our domestic insurance companies. The fourth area of the bill makes some changes in licensing to be consistent with the Producer License Model Act and federal law. We've eliminated some trainee licenses. We've added crop and surety licenses. We have removed some language on limited lines that made it more difficult. They made barriers for Alaskans to have licenses. We have required that surplus lines brokers also be licensed as producers. These license agreements don't have any particularly strong impact on our current group of agents, but they do bring us more into compliance with federal national areas. Fifth area that I would like to address briefly is a surplus lines area. There are several sections dealing with the surplus lines. And without going into a lot of technical discussion, I would like to point out that these are based on a task force that met over the summer. We had a group of surplus lines brokers, both from Alaska and from out of state, come in and work with the division staff and each other to streamline the process of surplus lines. Basically, a surplus lines company is a company that is not under a requirement to file their forms and taxes. We talked about document coverage, what kinds of documents needed to be given to the consumer. We placed some additional responsibility on brokers to make sure the consumer received notice of their responsibility. There are certain, what we call disclosures given in the surplus lines arena, which require surplus lines brokers to make sure the consumer understands the nature of a surplus lines placement, that it is not subject to form and rate filing, is also not covered by the Guarantee Association. And that is a requirement in current statute that we want to make sure stays there, and we've added another layer to that. The last major section I'd like to address deals with fraudulent activity. Section 40 of the bill provides that a person involved in the prevention and detection of fraudulent insurance acts would not be subject to civil liability when filing a report or furnishing information to others also involved in prevention and detection of insurance fraud. This addition to the current statute would allow fraud investigators from insurance companies to communicate with each other. Currently, fraud investigators from one insurance company can't communicate with fraud investigators from a second insurance company without fear of some kind of prosecution. They end up doing that through our office. Company A comes to us, thinks that there's fraud involved in a policy, asks that we get information from Company B. We'd like to facilitate communication to help prevent fraud in insurance in Alaska. Those are the six major areas. As I said, I won't go through all 28 pages. I would be happy to entertain questions, but the general overview of the entire bill is to bring Alaska more in line with the NAIC requirements and model regulations.
Thank you, Linda. Questions of Ms. Hall? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, if this is a cleanup bill, why wasn't a bill of this type submitted even prior to this administration? This is my question. Am I not correct that it is it or is not a cleanup bill?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, some of it is cleanup in the sense that we're trying to become more in conformity with national changes. I can't speak for why it wasn't done prior to now. There are changes at times in, for example, the reinsurance language has been changed at NAIC. There's discussion as new areas are found to need better oversight. There are changes adopted in model regulations. And so as that changes, we also want to make those changes as we feel it gives us a more stable, stronger oversight ability.
I could continue, Mr. Chairman. Is anybody opposed to the legislation? It seems to be straightforward.
To date, we had two hearings in Senate Labor and Commerce. There was no testimony on the bill at all. I understand there's no one in line to testify today. So no, I have only received two areas of comments. One resulted in the CS before you today. The other I feel we need to keep because it strengthens our oversight and our ability to make sure we have solvency in the reinsurance agreements that our domestic companies have. So those are the only two comments I've even received on the bill.
Industry's okay with it.
They haven't stood up and down and say yay, but they have certainly not objected. They have not testified. They have not contacted me.
And the most important question that I have, and the last of my questions, is that since a lot of our concerns have to do with insurance companies leaving the state, is there anything in this bill that would inhibit insurance company activity within the state or be a disincentive for them to be doing business within the state?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, and not to my knowledge, that's certainly a very great concern of mine. I would like to make this an environment that attracts insurance companies. We need more insurance companies because we are very limited at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Dyson and Senator Green.
Thank you. Once again, I just want to take a small opportunity to ask you, what's your sense of the magnitude of fraud problems in the state? And I assume that most of it is fraudulent activity on the provider, on the part of the provider, not the insurance company.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, we get, I'm going to say, at least 3 to 4 new reports of fraudulent insurance activities a month. We have an investigation section, and one of their primary roles today is the investigation of insurance fraud. Most of that fraud is, frankly, perpetrated by consumers who have filed claims that are found to not be valid. The damage to a car, for example, occurred prior to the purchase of the insurance policy. Those are the kinds of things. We are finding increasing instances of workers' compensation insurance fraud. And as I said, we now have 4 investigators, and that is their primary function. And I see fraud increasing, and we would like to take steps to stop that, because that also affects rates, it affects all the consumers that purchase insurance.
And so it isn't providers that are not, or that are, you don't see many providers that are involved in fraudulent activity?
Not many. We do have some ongoing investigations, but that's a smaller piece of the fraudulent activity.
All right, thank you.
Senator Dyson, Senator Green?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In answer to help answer Senator Olson's questions about the timeliness of this, I think that Ms. Hall is being a little modest. She probably brings more information and better background to this position than we've seen in a long time. And her status as an agent of the surplus lines and all the different things she did were kind of just very unique. And so she has had the ability to see some things that were badly needed, plus some things happening on the national level. And I'd also like to comment on the fraud that over the past several years at the federal level, there have been huge, huge corporate and FBI investigation consortiums that do nothing but house members in Washington to overlook and to do ongoing fraud investigations, which are of huge magnitude at the national level. And I'm sure that could have an impact here if that were to filter to Alaska. I'm not sure Alaska's their concern, but it's a major part of what insurance carriers deal with. And they have resident people who serve to function and work with investigators and doing fraud investigation at the national level.
Good information. Okay. Other questions of Ms. Hall? Let's turn our attention then to the amendment. We have amendment number 1, and I'll move that and object for clarification. This amendment was brought to us this morning by Representative Rochberg, and Janet Seitz is here this morning to present it. First thing we probably want to sort out, it's drafted to D. Does it still apply to H, Janet?
The new section, Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Janet Seitz, staff to Representative Rochberg. The reference to the new where the new section 2 goes is correct in the H version.
Okay, so it applies. So, Janet, if you would please let us know about this amendment, and welcome to Finance.
This amendment is dealing with the patient's Bill of Rights that Representative Rochberg had passed a few years ago, and it concerns what a contract between the participating health care provider and the managed care entity may or may not contain, and this section says it may not contain, and then it lists 3 things that the contract may not contain. The current statute uses the word and, which has now been interpreted to mean that all 3 things have to be present for the contract to violate the statute. That was not Representative Rochberg's intention. This changes the and to an or, And it was intended that the healthcare, to give the healthcare provider some choice about what they want to sign up for with the managed care entity on a contract.
Okay, let's, Senator Green?
Okay, could Janet please give me an example of a healthcare provider and an example of a managed care entity, just so I can kind of distinguish between the two?
Line 4 and 5.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Green, a healthcare provider would be a doctor, a dentist, an optometrist, and a managed care entity would be like the entity that provides the vision service program for the state of Alaska, VSP.
Anyone else?
Oh, yes, you know, insurance contracts, other, where the provider is Blue Cross, where the provider is signing up to participate in a program that offers the patients certain benefits. That's what this covers. It's supposed to make sure that the provider is not being forced by the managed care entity to accept all the product lines the provider offers, like financial incentives, or all the project. Ooh, I can't talk today. All the products that are offered by the entity, or if the doctor has a contract with company X, and then company Y comes in and says, well, you're going to provide services to me at the same rate as you do company X. That's the three examples in the statute. It gives a healthcare provider some choice in what contracts they're signing.
Does that help?
No. Does this have anything to do with what is it? The PPO or preferred provider?
Going to defer to Ms. Hall on that.
Linda, help us out. Talk a little bit about the amendment, and then we'll go to Senator Olson. Senator Olson, is that all right?
Just on this point.
I know the answer.
Okay. Senator Olson?
So does it have to do with the HMOs? Is that one of the entities you're talking about?
Help me. No, I don't think we have HMOs in Alaska.
We don't, but I'm wondering if we're heading that direction.
Well, I think we, through the chair, Senator Olson, I think that the managed care entity was a term of art that we used in the bill. And doesn't include it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Green, and then we'll go to Linda.
Okay, then do we have a definition of managed care entity in the statute?
All right. Linda, would you talk a little bit about the amendment?
My comments on the amendment, Mr. Chairman, were echoed by many of the things that were presented here. As I discussed this amendment with my lead life and health actuary, she also agreed that the intent of that bill, and apparently the division at that time supported the bill, was to attempt to make those contracts things that could not be required of providers. And the specific instance that I know prompted this did come through a vision plan. However, I think it could also apply to, and I can't give you a definition, Janet may have found it, of a managed care entity, frankly, but we're looking at contracts that provide for a whole list of services, and we don't want our providers to be tied into all providing all services in order to have a contract with one of the insurers. I think that's the goal. We don't want to limit what the provider has to provide so that they're doing things that they're really not comfortable doing or willing to provide as they enter into contracts with insurance companies.
So would you be supportive of the amendment or oppose the amendment?
I would support the amendment.
Other questions? Senator Bundy, any comment on the amendment from your side? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a definition of managed care entity in the statute. It's in Alaska Statute 2107090 sub 10. It includes insurer, hospital, medical service organization, health maintenance organization, employer or employee healthcare organization, a managed care contractor that operates a managed care plan, or a person who has a financial interest in healthcare services provided to an individual. So that covers a wide range, Mr. Chairman.
I got it. Thank you. Thank you.
Does that answer your question, Senator Green? Would you like a copy of that?
Oh, no. I can find it. Thank you.
Other discussion on Amendment Number 1? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Ms. Sykes. Have you had any input from some of the healthcare providers as to whether the, I see that it's the protection for the healthcare providers that have the health, any of the healthcare providers weighed in on the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, yes, we are doing this amendment at the request of a couple of healthcare providers. I believe in your packet there's a letter from one of them, Dr. Faulkner, and we have had contact from others concerning this particular section that they feel is onerous and forces them to accept a contract that they might not otherwise wish to participate in.
Senator Olson.
Continue, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking for more specific, not just the healthcare provider themselves, the individuals, but more of the organizations, whether it's the Dental Society or the Alaska State Medical Association or the nurse practitioner people that are out there.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, Dr. Faulkner is the director, is a director in the Alaska Optometric Association. I have pages, I think it was in your folder. No, but I do have a letter here from Dr. Faulkner, the executive director of the Alaska Optometric Association.
Sorry, everybody have that? This is the one you're speaking to, Jim?
No, this is another one, Mr. Different Chairman, one? That was just asking for the letter that Mr. Price wrote.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion, questions on Amendment Number 1? I'll withdraw my objection. Is there further objection to Amendment Number 1? Seeing none, Amendment Number 1 is incorporated into Version H. Other discussion on Version H as amended? It would be my intent to bring this back to us tomorrow. If there's any concerns from any members or the folks that would like to provide input, please let my office know, and we'll bring this up and expect to pass it out tomorrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Linda. Thanks, Janet, for your help. Before we turn to SJR 3, I just wanted to bring to the members' attention the fiscal note that just came in just before we began on Senate Bill 366. It's indeterminate, and the reason it is listed on pages 2 and 3, so I would just commend that to your reading, and that'll bring you up to date on where we are in 366. Okay, let's turn our attention to our ongoing project, SJR 3. Lucky, why don't you join us? Bruce, you're going to come back to the table with us. Anybody else? And SJR 3 is constitutional spending limit, and this what I thought we'd do today, and I guess I'll just turn it over to Senator Dyson. We have some amendments I thought we'd sort through and see if we can start to tie this up a bit. Senator Dyson, the floor is yours. Why don't you lead us on?
Yeah, and I will do this a little bit awkwardly, but bear with me. I think we'll get to the right place. First one that amendment I offer is number 5.
We're dealing with version B, Baker.
I believe that's correct. Is it?
That's right.
All right. And I'm looking for number 5 here with a number on it.
Everybody get. We have a list of amendments, and in fact, I think we had a couple more this morning. I think we're up to 10.
All right, we just got
number 5. Okay, amendment number 5 was a conceptual amendment from last week. So, Senator Dyson?
All right, thank you. What amendment number 5 does is has the effect of it is that the spending limit is repealed in 4 years. And it will require another action of us, or whoever is sitting here, to put it back on the ballot.
So it changes the word reconsideration to repeal in page 3, line 7. And the effect of this one leaves the old spending limit that was demonstrably ineffective gone. And it also leaves the old or present direct constitutional directive that we spend one-third of our money on capital, leaves it gone. So that's the effect of this one. If you choose to read, the other alternative would be Amendment 6 that would have, when SGR 3 is repealed in 4 years, it would leave the present ineffective spending limit in place and the one-third directive of or directing our us to spend one-third on capital. So I have chosen to put before you Amendment 5, which repeals the spending cap and leaves the old spending limit and one-third directive repealed.
Are you moving that as an amendment?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And I'll object for discussion. Okay, we have before us Amendment Number 5 and an explanation. Questions of Senator Dyson? Is there objection to Amendment Number 5? I'll remove mine. Okay, without objection, then Amendment Number 5 is incorporated into Version B. Senator Dyson? And then we'll then dispense with Amendment Number 6?
Yes, sir.
Okay, 6 is now void. Okay, Senator Dyson?
Number 7, I move Number 7.
Object for discussion.
And Lucky, would you, or Bruce, would you explain this, please?
Yes, sir. My name is Lucky Schultz.
Pardon? Lucky, stand by just a second. Senator Stevens?
I have 7.
Let's stand at ease, make sure we all have 7 in front of us. We have Amendment Number 7 on the table with objection. Senator Dyson.
Lucky?
Yes, my name is Lucky Schultz. Finance aide to Senator Dyson. In previous meetings, we had discussed the concept of having the legislature have the capability to declare extraordinary circumstance. In response to that inquiry, Amendment Number 7 adds a new subparagraph F on line 16 of page of the 7 amendment you have that allows the legislature to declare an extraordinary circumstance by a affirmative vote of two-thirds of each House and then passing it to the governor for signature. Contrary to a regular bill, which could be go into law if the governor did not sign it, this requires the governor to concur and approve the action so that both branches of the government have to approve extraordinary circumstance.
So walk us through that, Lucky. We come to town on the first Monday in January and we're faced with $100 million Medicaid bill. What happens?
You would create a bill as you would any other bill, except that rather than a simple majority, you need a two-thirds vote in both houses to move it to the governor, and the governor must approve it or veto it. He cannot let it go into law merely by not acting on it.
So it would be a normal appropriation bill.
That's right.
But it would require supermajority.
Yes, sir.
And the governor would still be bound by or still be privileged by his appropriation veto on that bill. Is that correct?
That is correct, sir.
Senator Hoffman?
Yes, that was my question B. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then if he did veto or reduce the expenditures, it would require a three-quarters vote override that veto?
That's correct, sir. Through the chair. Yes, sir.
It's a normal appropriation bill with the exception of instead of majority vote, it's a supermajority.
Yes, two-thirds.
Senator Green?
Mr. Chairman, I want to go back to the same thing I've mentioned previously. I think that we are really treading on dangerous ground, creating a new class of whereby we can declare an emergency where we've not defined it. And just sitting here the last 2 weeks, I've heard probably five or six examples of what might constitute an extraordinary emergency or extraordinary circumstance. Quite frankly, I don't think an increase in the Medicaid budget is an extraordinary. I think that's a given. But I can't imagine why we would say or consider that extraordinary, because it's a part of the track record of our history. And again, I go back to the difficulty we had just in changing the definition of a declaration of emergency. And if we're going to do this and not define very clearly what we're talking about, I think this is very problematic. And, this amendment doesn't matter if we leave Section D in the bill. We have other language for it. I don't know. I just want to put on the record, I am very concerned about the phrase extraordinary circumstance.
Senator Dyson and then Senator Huff.
Well, I appreciate Senator Green's remarks, and we have struggled trying to figure out how to anticipate all the different things that might come at us. And we very clearly decided that the present language on an emergency we don't want to mess with. We want the governor to have the freedom to deal with natural disasters and all kinds of things like that as it presently does. And the extraordinary circumstances, we've searched and not found that anyone has been successful at that either. And that's why we put, high sideboards on it, that leaves, the supermajority needs. And I believe also that Lucky, in talking again with Connecticut, who has this provision, I think that we inadvertently gave wrong information. And Lucky, would you update us on what Connecticut's experience has been?
Yes, sir. Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I need to correct something Senator Green commented and asked about the other day when I indicated there were no instances of Connecticut invoking extraordinary circumstance. Last night I received a call from their deputy legal counsel for the governor, and she informed me that they had indeed invoked, or the governor had indeed invoked the clause four times. And each of those circumstances were that they had record surplus revenues, that they had brought their budgetary reserve up to the limit, they were repaying tax rebates, and they were using the funds to pay off indebtedness that they had incurred in previous years for financial reasons.
Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I had a question in regards to your comments that separate legislation would be introduced. But under this this amendment, it wouldn't be possible to introduce language and have sections such as we have for the CBR and the extraordinary expenses be included in the normal operating budget, but just special sections that would have to be voted on separately for the two-thirds requirement.
The chair, sir, for helping up, I understand you correctly. Your question is with regard to the CBR?
No. Such as the CBR. We could have extraordinary circumstances within the normal operating budget, but there would be a separate vote that would require certain sections to get the normal two-thirds vote
through the
extraordinary circumstances in the normal operating budget.
Through the chair, Senator Huffman, that extraordinary vote would not, or supermajority vote would not be required if you're not exceeding the limit. This is only
right,
if you're exceeding
that,
the limit.
But if you were exceeding the limit, this provision can take place in the normal operating budget, but with a special vote on those sections.
The
that requires two-thirds.
To the chair, yes, sir, that's correct.
Senator Bundy?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment on Senator Green's concerns, and, you know, they're valid concerns. I am reminded, though, that we often hear that one of the geniuses of our Constitution was that it did not nail down a lot of specifics in the Constitution, but provided a substantial amount of latitude for future legislatures to be able to have some, a good bit of flexibility. And so while I understand and would be certainly opposed to providing a loophole, I think in this case I would support the idea that, excuse me, that we be broad in our interpretation of extraordinary circumstance, knowing that our powers of predicting the future are limited, and that we should have at least as much confidence in future legislators as we would have in ourselves.
Senator Green?
Just a response, Senator, but I was as much concerned about the conversation we've had at this table about examples for what an extraordinary circumstance might be, were that to ever be cited in any litigation. And I want us to be very sure that we're not without intending to defining what an extraordinary circumstance is. I want us to be very careful about what that is.
I share your concern, and I sit and I wonder if the mere fact that it takes two-thirds vote, that vote makes it an extraordinary circumstance, just by the level, the threshold you have to cross
history.
That makes it extraordinary, but I understand that we're dancing on a pin here. Senator Bundy?
Well, and again, and I think Senator Green and I are in agreement, maybe coming from slightly different angles, but in agreement that it ought to be clear on the record that we, the current Finance Committee, have not come to agreement to what constitutes an extraordinary circumstance. So none of the examples we've listed should be used as precedent setting, but that is all. The precedent is that a future Finance Committee would probably have just as much of a challenge deciding and defining an event as an extraordinary circumstance.
Yeah. Senator Hoffman, did you have your hand up?
Oh, okay. It was Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I believe you all, or we have in times past, in constitutional issues, put in a phrase to the effect that the legislature may define in statute, you know, terminology. And I don't believe I would have a problem with that being added. I know I was looking at the Constitution the other day, and when on the privacy phrase that's in our Constitution, there's actually a phrase in there that says the legislature may define, or something to those effects, you know, in statute, what the phrases mean. And echoing Senator Bundy's remarks, I suspect if we were really concerned about that might be the appropriate solution, is that this or future legislatures might define that phrase in statute.
So that may be something for us to think about for conceptual amendment number 11.
Yeah, I'm not offering that.
Oh, I understand.
And,
something to think about.
I would prefer that we go forward with what we have, but it is an option for us.
Understand. Okay. Further discussion on amendment number 7. Is there any, I'll withdraw my objection. Is there further objection to adopting amendment number 7? Seeing none, amendment number 7 is adopted as part of version B.
Yeah, I move amendment number 8.
Object for discussion. Senator Dyson?
Thank you. And I believe that this one comes from the administration, and it really has to do with allowing for or clarifying the language to on duplicate payments. Is that correct, Mr. Schultz?
Bruce?
Yes, for the record, Bruce Tangeman with Legislative Finance. The previous wording referred more to IA receipts, which is one agency has appropriated GF, another agency has appropriated IA receipts to receive the GF from the agency or a portion of it. And we didn't want the GF to be counted and the IA to be counted, both. The new language incorporates not only IA receipts, but other funding sources, such as when you load the Marine Highway System with $30 million, and then the Marine Highway System expends that $30 million. We don't want $60 million counted. That was not included under the previous language, and we believe this doesn't include that.
Questions on amendment number 8?
It's just kind of almost an intergovernmental transfer there.
Yes, sir.
So it doesn't get counted twice.
Correct.
All right. Thank you.
Other discussion on amendment number 8? I'll withdraw my objection. Is there further objection to amendment number 8? Seeing none, amendment number 8 is adopted to version B. Senator Dyson?
Thank you. All right. And I believe the next one we should deal with is number 9. I move amendment number 9.
I object for discussion.
Yeah.
Amendment number 9, I think we just got today. And it has some pieces attached to it. Is that correct?
I think it should have some graphs here.
This, lucky, is this part of 9?
You have. No, so that's just support information.
Okay.
The only thing you're going to need today is the new colored graph that Legislative Finance provided to us this morning.
The amendment number 9, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. This is what I inappropriately said was fiddling with the base numbers in order to get the results we wanted. But my guess is that what the final 2004 budget comes up with and what we finally approve will probably reduce the amount of fiddling here. But what it really does is smooths the curve out and eliminates the flat first two or three years because of the budget reductions that were done. And the administration is asked this for this in order to have the flexibility in the first year that the budget, this constitutional spending limit would apply, which I think is the 2006 year, allows for a reasonable amount of growth based on inflation and population growth. Lucky or Bruce, would you correct anything I've misstated?
Yes, to the chair, if I may address this a little bit further. In the other states that have what are referred to as tax expenditure limits, TELs, those states that have a formula that allows the number to go negative have experienced economic distress, shall we say. And so the recommendation has been that never let your numbers go negative because it adversely impacts the economies of the state. What they recommend is that in a year it goes negative, you hold it at the same level as last year. Unfortunately for us, that means we have several years it would be level. If you look at the chart, the very bottom graph is the way the language currently reads without the amendment. So you have FY06, 7, 8, and 9 at the current level, which has the same impact as a ratchet down effect that would have an adverse effect on the economy. So our recommendation is to adjust the base year such that you get a smooth flow from the onset that matches the rest of the graph. And by inserting numbers that we think are probably going to be pretty close to the actuals anyway, of $3.3 billion and $3.4 billion for FY04 and FY05 of the total budget, less the exemptions, we end up with that graph. And so the graph that would result as a result of this amendment is the second lineup in the dark blue that shows the average with an adjusted base year. It shows an increase annually in the ballpark of $50 million.
So the bill as drafted now is line 9. Thank you, Bruce, for bringing this back with line numbers.
Yes, sir.
Is line 9. Is that correct, Lucky? And that is the purple asterisk line on the bottom?
Correct.
Okay. Yes, sir. And amendment number 9 takes us to which line?
What amendment number 9 does, it takes us over to page 3 for a transition period under section 3, section 30 application.
It takes us to line 23?
Well, if we begin on line, on version B of the draft of the bill, go to page 3, line 7 for the title. This becomes a transition clause rather than so that the base year language remains the same except for the transition period. And we're using these numbers for FY04 and 05 as a transition period. After FY05, then we go back, it reverts back to the appropriation limit language as established on page 1, begin on line 6.
Lucky, is that shown on our chart?
Yes, sir. What happens when this would be the second graph up, the dark blue, the small blue diamonds called average growth, adjusted base years, is the result of applying the new formula.
Okay. Senator Hoffman. So the bill is drafted, is line number 9 on our chart.
Correct.
The amendment takes us to which line?
Line 5.
Takes us to line 5, which is graphed at the bottom. Okay, Senator Hoffman.
Yesterday when we were talking, and there is no difference between the chart 2 from yesterday and this chart, it's just that they're colored. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that's correct. I added the lines and columns as requested.
But yesterday when we were discussing the same graph, then I had the understanding when you made your presentation that we are under the two-year growth, and that would have been the line 23 that the legislation or the proposed amendment was at. So what you're doing here, if we adopt this amendment, we're now going to line 5.
The chair, Senator Huffman, the purpose of this amendment is to adjust the base year. Amendment number 10 that will follow this one will move us to the green line, the two-year growth, in response to the administration's request that $50 million per year increase is not sufficient. But amendment number 9 just changes the base year application.
So amendment number 9 takes us from, on our chart, from line 9 to line 5. Amendment number 10, if adopted, will take us down to line 23.
Yes, sir.
Is that okay? Cheryl, do you want to join us at the table? You're welcome to. Yeah, Senator Hoffman?
That's when you go and look and compare lines 5 and lines 23, and you look at columns D and E, under both of those scenarios, the numbers are the same. And the testimony that I recall yesterday was that we were looking at the two-year growth as the adjusted base years, and that's where I thought that we were, and why now it seems as though we're ratcheting it down to line 5, but the amendment, when you're talking about, as I said, in lines 5 and 23, columns D and E, the numbers are the same of 3.3 billion and 3.404 and 3.4 billion 405. So why, I don't see how these numbers change the lines that we're at when the columns are identical.
To the chair, Senator Hoffman, you are correct. Yesterday we were talking about a two-year growth. We did not make that amendment yesterday, and that's why amendment number 10 will address that. This amendment, again, number 9, changes only the base year, and then the amendment number 10 will build on that to move us from a three-year average to a two-year cumulative growth change.
Senator Hoffman, with this up through 10. Amendment 10. Halfway there. Okay. Senator Dyson.
Yeah. And, you know, Senator Hoffman's always been a Hawkeye, and I appreciate it. What you'll see is that between, is it line 8 and line 26 will change with amendment number 10, and that built upon the changing of the base year gives the administration the kind of flexibility that they believe is necessary for reasonable budget growth, and you're exactly on the right track, and I'm sorry that the way we're presenting it is a bit confusing. We couldn't figure out a better way, but I think we get to where the administration wants to go and what is reasonable.
Other discussion on amendment number 9? I'll withdraw my objection. Is there further objection to adopting amendment number 9? Seeing none, it's adopted as amendment number 9 to version B. Senator Dyson?
Yeah, I move it. Amendment number 10.
Back for discussion. Senator Dyson?
Thank you. I am going to let Bruce and Cheryl Lucky explain, but indeed what it does is changes the averaging that happens on both, I believe, in change in population and the inflation from 3 years to 2 years, and gives a more rational result. Ms. Fresca.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dyson. If I could, Bruce is the Cheryl,
identify yourself.
Thank you, sorry. Cheryl Fresca, Office of Management and Budget.
Thank you.
And Bruce is the one who's been the magisteer on the numbers and came up with the suggested language. So I'd like for him to proceed, if that's okay.
Sure.
Through the chair. The way the bill is currently written, we're using an average annual growth for our population and our inflation rates over 3 of the last 4 years. When you apply that to the base, you get substantially lower growth than what you were expecting. So for instance, if population and inflation growth were 4% every year over those 3 years, the average would be 4%. You'd be applying, in order to calculate 06, you'd be applying 4% to the average base year, which would be '02, '03, '04, which in essence is '03. So you're increasing your '06 budget by 4% over the amount appropriated in '03, which in essence is 1.3% a year. When we ran the numbers, that got us to our 50 million approximately growth per year, which was a little too low, we thought. The proposed amendment would take us to 2 years of cumulative growth. And again, it would still be applied to the same base year of 3 years ago, but instead of averaging your 4% over 3 years, you'd be adding your 4% over 2 years. So you'd be applying 8% growth to a base year 3 years ago, which would in essence be approximately 2.6% growth over all those years. And that gets us to approximately 100 million a year.
Senator Hoffman?
And that would hold true as long as you saw increases every year. But if inflation decreased, you would have a slower growth rate under the two-year average as compared to the three-year average.
Through the chair, it would be even lower the way it's written now.
You'd have a higher growth rate if in one year was a low, because you'd have the two to average out to the negative. So under the three-year average, if you actually had deflation in 1 year, the higher growth rate would be under the three-year average.
The actual growth rate might be high or lower.
Average growth rate.
The average growth rate might be lower, but you would still be using an average applied to a base year of 3 years ago. So it would keep your growth rate even lower, I believe. I'd have to look into that. But if you're still starting with approximately 50 million, it would even be lower than that. But there is a section in the bill that does not allow for negative appropriation or a decrease in the amount appropriated from year to year. So that might take care of that.
You know, it might be really helpful for us and others that contemplate this in the future that if we did what amounts to a timeline, you know, 00, 01, 02, 03, and then you'd look at 06 and there could just be a arrow that would go back and show the 3 years that you're averaging out, and that's what the basis of this year is. I think that's what we're doing here, and it would maybe help us visualize that. So we understand, because I think we're struggling with the look-back part of it.
Mr. Cheryl? Chairman, if I could, I think Bruce the other day explained it really succinctly, and I finally got it, too, because it is obtuse, frankly. But you take the last 2 years, the average of the last 2 years, right? But or in this case, the cumulative average. And then you just simply add that to what was 3 years ago, okay? So just... Is that right? Okay. So take the last two fiscal years, what was the cumulative allowed growth? And whatever that answer is, if it's 8%, then you apply it to what was the spending 3 years in 3 years ago.
Okay. If this was in place today, and today we're dealing with the 05 budget, tell us what we would be dealing with.
Okay. So that 03 plus 04, right?
Correct, for your indices, for your population.
Well, 304 what?
That would be your population and inflation growth.
We're not through 04 yet. So,
yeah, that's the
right. So actually,
it's 02 and
03. It's 02 and 03.
That's calendar years 2 and 3 for population and inflation.
And we would be applying that to an average of FY 01, 02, and 03 for the base year.
Where does that say that it's calendar year?
In the through the chair, Senator Huffman, in the bill. On page one. On page one, on line, beginning on line 10, is the factor that addresses inflation. And if you look on line 12, it talks about you're looking at the calendar year for inflation that corresponds with the fiscal year. That is the base year that we're dealing with. On page two, beginning on line one, you begin talking about the population factor. And on line two, we talk again the calendar year that addresses population corresponding to the fiscal year that we're addressing. Because the information for population and inflation is provided on a calendar year basis.
Calendar year taken care of. Okay, so today we're talking about FY05. What would we be thinking of?
We would then be looking at from the federal indices for population and inflation, we'd be looking at the actual numbers for calendar year 02 and 03. We'd be adding those together and applying it to our base year average, which is 01, 02, and 03.
How do we know the 03 population change?
As I recall, sir, the population change comes out in July of the calendar year, estimated for the end of the year.
By whom?
Alaska Department of Labor.
And so do they do an annual population estimate that's trued up every 10 years? Is that how that works? And then inflation, if we were in inflation, the CPI out of Anchorage, that also is an estimate until mid-04? So we would be dealing with estimateds?
I believe that is provided at the end of the calendar year on December 31st for that year.
I mean, they
may want to check that. There's a lag. I know when we're dealing with lag. Education stuff.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it's usually finalized mid to late April.
Okay.
For the preceding calendar year.
So would we then be able to contemplate a budget then if we're starting in January using 03 numbers?
And that's why we went back to 2 years. You don't have 04 for doing 05, but we do have 03 numbers because it came out in April of 04.
The population estimate would come out in April of 03. The inflation wouldn't come out until April of 04. So would we be able to build a budget without knowing that inflation number? Cheryl?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Brad just, Pierce from OMB just provided, inflation does come out in February. Population comes out in March, and then personal income is what comes out in April. So for what that means, but
I believe they're calculated on a quarterly basis also. So we would have three actual quarters, and then an estimate on December 31st for the final quarter, which would be firmed up then in February and March.
Except wouldn't the administration be building a budget that you're going to bring out on December 15th? And that budget would need numbers that you wouldn't have available. Or maybe you'd have available through quarterly estimates, and then it would have to be trued up come February, February and March. Is that?
Mr. Chairman, if you could, if you'd like us to, I think you've raised a very good point. And if we did come up with a timeline, frankly, I think that would help answer a lot of these questions and add in when the information is available. And the other thing to consider is really what we're talking about is the change from 1 year to the next as a percentage. And so even though we may not have down to the actual population count, you know, it's probably in the rounding, it wouldn't be that significant. But frankly, we're used to doing budgets based on estimates, such as revenues. So, but it would influence it. But if you could, we could go back and do that for you. I think it would help.
A timeline would help me. I don't know about the rest of the committee, but Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you, and I appreciate the questions from the chair. And I think that what the chair is asking for is now, if we pass Amendment 10, that you give us a graph and so on. It shows us what would the spending limit we would be dealing with for the budget we're working on, which is the 05, and it shows us when these pieces of information come to us. That would be really helpful. And then I just remind the chair and everybody else that hopefully this administration and all of us are always building a budget based upon what the needs of the people of Alaska are, you know, to provide the level of service that administration and the legislature agree on, and that the spending limits are only guardrails that are out there, you know, on the edges of it, and ought not to be driving our public policy debate. They're only the guardrails to keep us from careening into the ditch again. Or maybe strike that. And shouldn't be driving the public policy debates on budget, nor should, in my view, the revenue driving the upper limits of the budget, you know, and only the lower limits based upon what we, the triage we have to go through with available resources and diminishing CBR.
Okay, other discussion on number 10. Bruce?
If I could make a clarification, it was pointed out, and after reading the language again, this does get a little confusing, but it says, let's see, line 12, or let's start with the line 11, page 1. At the end, are compiled by a federal agency during the second and third calendar year preceding the calendar year during which the immediately preceding fiscal year began. Therefore, 04 started in 03, 2 years before that would be 01 and 02. So we'd be using 01 and 02 numbers, not 02 and 03. Therefore, we would have actual numbers for 01 and 02 for population and inflation.
Back to the timeline. Okay.
Yes. Even more need for it.
This several times. Yeah, I know you have. Senator Green.
You know, Tracy on my staff went through the document.
Senator Green, get a little closer to that.
Oh, I've been hitting it all day. And X'd out what will be deleted by Amendment 10,
okay,
and what will remain. It is much clearer. If you would like, 10. I would have this copied, cleaned up and copied, and take my comments off of it and give it to the other members, and it makes it much easier to understand if you want me to.
Why don't we,
meeting.
Yeah, why don't we just suggest that we adopt Amendment number 10, and then we'll have that cleaned up and bring it back to us just as soon as possible. What you're saying, Senator Green, is the amendment cleans up this gibberish on line 10 through 13. Bruce, do you agree with that?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay. Okay, thank you, Senator Green, for that. That helps us. Okay, anything else on number 10? Senator Hawk?
And I want to look at this as it relates to this year's capital budget, because we're spending very little in capital this year, and I don't think that that's going to be the norm over the last decade. I think the capital budget has been right around $100 million in general funds. I know that funds aren't included in our numbers, but if we say that we spent $100 million last year and then we spend only $20 million in capital and everything else remains constant, so that's $120 million, the average there is $60 million, you know, that would, under that scenario, that would even eat up the $56 million that's available under the cap. And would, you know, I don't want to get back into what Senator Green talked about, but would that be considered an extraordinary circumstance? And that's how we would have to address the problem if we wanted to spend additional dollars in capital?
Rhetorical question. Senator Bundy?
Well, related to what Senator Hoffman said and what Senator Dyson said earlier, that this is to be sideboards. And I would hope that future legislators would view it as sideboards. But my past experience in human nature suggests that the spending limit will be the base. And I would just use that as today's recent experience. You know, the price of oil is up. We were going to have to take $200 million less of our savings, but then there was a group of citizens, mostly focused on the NEA, that suggested we had $200 million of new money that we should pump into education. I think those sideboards will be a base, but another view of human nature, perhaps, but not shared by all.
You only wanted $150 million. Okay. Good comments. Okay, anything else on number 10? I'll withdraw my objection. Is there further objection to adopting amendment number 10? Seeing none, amendment number 10 is included in version B. Okay. Dyson, where are we?
We're done. And with your permission, we will have a new bill drafted that be a committee substitute, I believe, that incorporates all the amendments that you've adopted, and put that before you with a new graph and the timeline, hopefully by the next couple days. And I really appreciate the both the wisdom of the committee and the marvelous assistance we've had from Bruce and OMB. And I think we've got, I don't know how to improve the product now, but I'm, any further suggestions, we'd be glad to respond to.
One of our colleagues, Senator Stedman, did a sensitivity analysis a month ago on the original bills, and it showed that as the population and the inflation changed, what you got for, or what you added or subtracted, depending on those variables. I wonder if Senator Stedman might help us a bit now that you've refined this, and so we can just do some what-ifs without having to go through this every time. So I'd suggest perhaps that's a place once that we do. The other thing is they're working on a spending limit on the other side. Has there been anyone that's done what amounts to a side-by-side between the two? I haven't paid any attention to what's going on over there. I don't know if we have. But it may be worthwhile if they're all the same, fine. If there are some glaring differences, it might be interesting for us to see those. Not too big of a thing.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, in fact, Brad from ONB and I just had that discussion yesterday about doing that, because we have been tracking what's been going on in the House side.
And Senator Dyson? And my sense is that they are paying attention to what we're doing here. They think that we're a bit ahead of them, and there's the last iteration I saw. They didn't have the provision that we put in that puts a ratchet on it so it doesn't go down, and so on. And we're going to provide you with some information here from some national sources that we've been talking with, and it seems to me the experience of other jurisdictions shows the wisdom of the final product we're getting to here, and I am more convinced than ever than what Mr. Cuddy said here, that having constitutional spending limits, the record appears to that the states who have a good one, like what we're contemplating here, have seen significant investment in economic growth, that Mr. Cuddy's remarks that that gives investors a great deal of more comfort about investing in states that have an effective limit, because it eliminates the danger of them, a new and successful industry, being seen as the deep pocket that might be raided. And I don't know if anybody has the data that could show that that's more than correlation, you know, that there's a cause and effect thing, but I think it's a significant part of the groundwork that we want to set for encouraging people to invest in our state. I'm encouraged by that.
It may be interesting to, we have Fitch, Standard & Poor's, Moody's. It may be interesting to see, I mean, they look across all of our states and see what the effect constitutional spending limits have had. I would think they'd be rock solid information. So maybe some place we want to explore. Okay, let's see. The other thing is, I think that's it. Anything else on SJR 3? Senator Dyson will go get another version, bring it back, and any concerns, please pass it on to me and so we can push this along. Anything else come before the committee? We'll set SJR 3 aside. Tomorrow, Senator Stevens, we'll have Senator Stevens with 366. We're going to have Senate Bill 255, a new bill having to do with illegal use of a traffic preemption device. We're going to have Senate Bill 350 having to do with the Four Dam Pool Joint Action Agency. We're going to be briefed by the Department of Administration on the two or three contracts that have been closed out. We've asked for a breakdown of the agreements as they relate to the fiscal issues, and if there's any major work rule changes. So they're going to come and brief us on that, and then we'll have SB 366. So we'll have a full day tomorrow. Senator Dyson.
Is it your intention that we move the joint action, the Four Dam Pool and the joint, that bill out?
I don't know. I haven't really looked at it. So let me know if you do or you don't. So, but I haven't looked at it. I had one briefing on it, and that's all I know about. Senator Dyson?
And I think I'm going to want a little time on that one, so I would probably encourage you to not move it.
Sure. Just let me know what you folks want to do. Okay. Anything else come forth, committee? Thanks, everybody. We're adjourned.